Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. NASA leads the nation on a great journey of discovery, seeking new knowledge and understanding of our sun, Earth, solar system, and the universe, out to its farthest reaches and back to its earliest moments of existence. To do this, it invests on the order of $3 billion annually in fundamental and applied research and technology development across a broad range of topics, including space and earth sciences, life and physical sciences, human health, aeronautics, and technology. From space, in space, and about space, NASA's science vision encompasses questions as practical as hurricane formation, as enticing as the prospect of a lunar resources, and as profound as the origin of the universe. To ensure the success of the space program through generations to come, we must have simple but compelling long-term goals and a coherent, thoughtful plan. What are NASA's key science priorities? What is NASA doing to promote science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM education? And when will we have definitive evidence of life outside of Earth? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Ellen Stofan, NASA's chief scientist. Ellen, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd like to get some context. Would you outline the mission and purpose of NASA's Office of Chief Scientist? What prompted its creation and how has it evolved to date?
Well, it's an interesting office because it's sort of come and gone over the history of the agency. And really, my primary function is to advise the NASA administrator on science policy across the agency. We have an associate administrator for science whose responsibility it is to administer our program budgets. So if it's a mission to Mars or an Earth science mission, the associate administrator for space science is really in charge of that. I'm really looking at broad-scale science policy across the agency, across our multiple directorates. That's human exploration, technology, science, and aeronautics, and giving the administrator kind of a big-picture point of view. So the position comes and goes, whether the administrator wants that kind of advice or doesn't. But really the main focus is can my office provide the administrator with this sort of broad point of view?
So Ellen, given your role as NASA's chief scientist, do you work very closely with the associate administrator of the science directorate?
Yes. Right now we have an acting associate administrator, and I work very closely with him, really thinking about what he's doing, policy, how the missions are going, the big decisions he's having to make. So I meet with him very regularly. I also work extremely closely with the associate administrator for human exploration, Bill Gerstenmaier, because we are very tightly tied in, again, with the research that we're doing on the International Space Station, but also on NASA's journey to send humans to Mars in the 2030s. So my office is quite involved in that.
And being so quite involved, I'd like to get – you kind of hinted at it, but what are your responsibilities and duties? And really, maybe – what's a day – let's put it this way. What's a day or a week in the life of NASA's chief scientist?
You know, I often think I have the best job in the world because my days are so incredibly varied. So I might start out going to a meeting, hearing about our latest accomplishment with one of my favorite programs, SERVEER, which is a joint project between USAID and NASA to help countries around the world get access to NASA Earth science data. So I might have a meeting about that. I might then have a meeting on diversity and inclusion. How are we doing at NASA in terms of making sure we have a diverse and inclusive workforce, but then how are we also making sure that promulgates outward, for example, to institutions we give grants to? Then I might have a meeting over at the Office of Science and Technology Policy. I sit on a number of committees through the National Science and Technology Council, including, for example, the Interagency Arctic Research Panel. I sit on a Deputies Ocean Council. I sit on a Physical Science Subcommittee. So I'm quite involved doing cross-agency type activities, which are really interesting. Then I might, have a briefing with staff on Capitol Hill. I might have a meeting with members of the science community who want to come in and talk about a specific issue or an area of research. And then we might have a budget meeting. It is Washington after all.
It is Washington after all. So, speaking of Washington after all, what are your top say, I don't know, management challenges or organizational challenges that you face? And how have you sought to address those challenges?
You know, I think for NASA, every day we're trying to turn science fiction into science fact. So if you say that's our, you know, that's our top challenge is we want to send humans to Mars in the 2030s, you know, and that's a big challenge. How do you take an agency of over 17,000 civil servants, you know, 9 NASA centers and 1 FFRDC spread all across the country? How do you move everybody forward and make sure that we're all in sync? And, you know, we probably have twice that many contractors working for us. So we're a big agency and we're trying to do really tough things. And, you know, we work hard every day to make sure we're using the taxpayer dollars to the maximum we can get out of them to make sure that we move this agency forward and keep us as a leader in exploration, in discovery, in science.
So what has surprised you most since taking this role?
You know, I think one of the things that's probably surprised me most, which is really not a silly thing. You know, NASA for the last 4 or 5 years has been voted the best place to work in the federal government. And the dedication of everybody that I run into at the agency, who we might not always agree on an implementation path, but I have never questioned anybody's motivation. Everybody is passionate about NASA's mission, exploration, discovery, understanding this planet, understanding our solar system. And I think what's amazed me is the degree. I grew up at NASA, and so I'm incredibly passionate about the agency, but it's been incredibly refreshing just to see that in every single person I work with.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you grew up, it runs in your family, so to speak, NASA. So I'd like to know a little bit more about you and your career path. What brought you to your current leadership role?
Well, you know, when I was going way, way back, I went to my first rocket launch when I was 4 years old because my dad really was a rocket engineer. He worked at NASA's now Glenn Research Center. At that point, it was the Lewis Research Center in Cleveland. And he worked on launch vehicles. And so I went down there for a rocket launch and the rocket actually blew up on the pad, which is probably why I never wanted to be an astronaut. But, you know, to me, NASA was just always something, you know, when I was a kid, I was defending why NASA, we should be sending people to the moon and why it was important to spend money on science and technology when I was about 10 years old. But I was also one of those kids who picked up rocks and seashells and I loved the outside world. And at some point when I was about 10, I think my mother was taking a geology class and I went along on the trip and I was like, wow, people get paid for picking up rocks for a living. But to be honest with you, what fascinated the most is we're walking down the stream bed and this geology professor could read the history of the Earth by looking at these layers of rocks. And I just thought that was amazing that you could read landscapes and get history and information out of them. And so I thought, okay, I want to be a geologist, even though I had never known that was a thing before. And then when I was about 14, my father was in charge of the launch vehicles that launched the Viking landers, which were the first two U.S. landers on Mars. They launched in 1975, to date myself. And we went down to the launch because my father was working on it. And they had presentations by the mission scientists to explain why we were exploring Mars, to understand this red planet with water flowing across the surface in its past, where maybe at one point there was life. And this guy named Carl Sagan was talking about why we explore Mars. And I thought, okay, I'm sold. That's it. And so I got a PhD in planetary geology. I studied the surface of Venus primarily for my PhD, worked on a number of NASA missions, mission to Venus. I'm on the Cassini mission that's studying Saturn right now. And I worked on an instrument that flew twice on the shuttle in 1994. And at some point, they called me and said, do you want to interview to be chief scientist of NASA? And I thought, okay, I'll try that. I had to Google that to figure out what on earth does the chief scientist of NASA do? And it sounded great. And so that's what I've done.
You mentioned in your challenge, the challenge that you talked about was getting something. NASA was such an important, varied mission with so many people going in that, trying to achieve that mission. It takes leadership. And where I want to go with this question is, given your background, your current role, what makes an effective leader? And perhaps you could illustrate some of the leaders that have influenced you and how you've put some of those principles into practice.
Well, I've had a number of leadership roles in my career. I was I ran a science team and its budget for the shuttle instrument I was talking about, and probably my biggest leadership role, I actually put together a proposal that I worked on for about 5 years to send a boat to a sea on Titan, which is one of Saturn's moons. And so we worked for about 5 years on this proposal. We made it through an initial NASA round, and then we eventually lost to another NASA mission that got selected. And so leading a team of people trying to do something really hard, sending a floating probe to a sea on a very distant moon, sort of taught me a lot about leadership styles. But even more than that, it really was working with really great leaders. Steve Saunders, who was a project scientist on the Magellan mission to Venus that I worked on very early, to me taught me one of the most important lessons, which is listening. As a leader, I think you always have to really listen to what people around you say and understand what the situation is and understand what's motivating them. And he was really, really good at that. My biggest admiration right now is solely for Charlie Bolden, our NASA administrator, who I think really exemplifies being a great leader. He's extremely passionate about the agency, about its mission. He has a very clear vision, which I think leaders have to have, of where he thinks the agency should go. And then he's able to communicate that vision, which I think is another important aspect of leadership, is really that communication piece. Can you let the people who are helping you achieve those goals, can you communicate to them and get them on board with you? And then can you communicate that message to your stakeholders, so upward and outward, so that they support you? And Charlie's great at that.
What are NASA's key science priorities? We will ask its chief scientist, Dr. Ellen Stofan, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.